This is Ethan Elkind, and welcome to State of the Bay. Later on in the hour, we'll review a sweeping package of new climate and energy bills that Governor Newsom signed late last week, overhauling California's energy and climate policy. And we'll also meet the creator of the new musical, The Day the Sky Turned Orange. If you happen to be in the Bay Area on September 9th, 2020, you might remember that strange day. But first, the Bay Area has a new championship sports team. The Oakland Ballers professional baseball team is just in its second year. But last night, the team came back from being down 2-0 in a 5-game playoff series to win its third straight game, bringing Oakland a new sports championship. And the city and its sports fans certainly needed it. Oakland has lost 3 professional sports teams in the past 7 years. It's painful to list them, but the Golden State Warriors moved to San Francisco, Oakland Raiders moved to Las Vegas, and supposedly the Oakland A's baseball team is moving to Las Vegas as well and currently are in Sacramento. But the Ballers, along with teams like the Oakland Roots and Seoul soccer clubs, are helping to fill that gap for local East Bay sports fans. And I'm pleased to be joined now by Brian Carmel, co-founder of the Oakland Ballers, to talk about their successful season and what's ahead for the team. So welcome to State of the Bay, Brian.
Thank you. How are you doing?
I am doing great. I was a really responsible journalist and attended the game last night, this big double elimination game. So congratulations on the win, on the championship, a fantastic season. The Ballers broke the Pioneer League modern era wins record, along with winning the championship last night against the Idaho Falls Chuckers. So can you just tell us a bit about the game and how you're feeling today?
Sure. I mean, I'm feeling a little tired. I'll start there. It's been a long season, you know, 96 games, 48 home games, and then the playoffs. And it's just been a whirlwind, but also a beast to put on that many games. You know, we are we're a startup. we don't have a big staff. We don't have a big team. We have a mighty team. And so just to put on games for, you know, we have 4,100 seats. So for 4,000 fans is a Herculean effort for us, but just to end the way we did felt incredible, especially because we were down, you know, 0-2. Not a lot of teams come back in 5-game series that start in an 0-2 hole. So felt really good to end things the way we did.
Well, it was quite a moment for the community. I was struck with the Oakland Fire Department trucks coming out. Of course, Oakland Mayor Barbara Lee was there. The fire department was spraying the field. The players were celebrating. Let's go, Oakland chants. What was that vibe like for you? And how were the celebrations afterwards? I know it continued on to that nearby Prescott Market next to the ballpark.
Oh, it was just incredible. Honestly, it was magical. Yeah, we had the mayor. We had city council members. We had Too Short this weekend. Tajay from Souls of Mischief. Jay Walt. You know, Bip Roberts, great Oakland baseball player, was there. And it just, you know, it was palpable. I mean, that's awesome that you were there. So you felt the energy. You know, you mentioned the firefighters coming through. I took BART to the stadium yesterday, and I was walking from West Oakland BART to Ramondi Park, and I walked by the fire station, and I just walked in. You know, I introduced myself. I said, "Hey, I'm co-founder of the Ballers." They come to a lot of games and they just stop by and we give them a shout out on the video board. And I said, "Are you guys going to come by today?" And they said, "Of course, if you want us to." And then, you know, we started brainstorming what could we do after the game. And they're like, "Well, we've got this really big hose. We could spray you guys with water." And I said, "Absolutely." I didn't tell anybody. And I was texting with Ben from the fire station, and he's like, "Now? You ready?" And I literally texted him. I was like, "Okay, go ahead, spray us down." And it was just such a magical moment. The players all ran to the water and we were rolling around in the grass. And honestly, like storybook ending, never experienced anything like that.
That's a pretty amazing serendipity, and got to be the first time of fire truck has sprayed a championship baseball team like that. So truly a remarkable moment. Well, I'm sure there are many listeners who maybe haven't heard of the Ballers or haven't been to a game. Can you just describe what an Oakland Ballers home game is like, how it might be different from other professional baseball games they've been to?
Sure. Yeah. So we're a baseball team. We're in Oakland. We play in West Oakland at Ramondi Park. We're in the Pioneer League. The Pioneer League is a historic independent baseball league. It's been around since 1939. The level of play is tremendous. A lot of folk, you know, a lot of players that go on to be, you know, Hall of Fame MLB stars come through the Pioneer League. Everybody from Frank Thomas to Frank Robinson, to Clayton Kershaw, and the list continues. And so, you know, our players are usually ages about 21 to 25 or so. It's a development league. These are the guys that maybe just fell outside of the MLB draft, but are, you know, absolutely can get there. Maybe they went to a D3 school instead of a D1 school, and so they got overlooked by scouts. And so the play is tremendous and the vibe is tremendous. You know, our design principle is sort of 48 block parties around a baseball game. So all season long, we bring in musical acts. You know, we've got murals all around the stadium. We partner with all sorts of cultural groups, from the zoo to the Oakland Symphony, to the Unity Council from East Oakland, and you know, the Black Panther Party, and I could go on and on. And this sort of atmosphere that we're trying to create is a love letter to Oakland. You know, you mentioned the Major League team leaving Oakland, and you know, all those pro sports teams leaving Oakland, as they have in the last 5 years. And so our idea is for the Ballers to just be a giant hug to the community in Oakland. And I think people have really responded to that. We are in the business of manufacturing joy. And I think we manufactured a lot of joy this season, and you can see it on the faces of the fans as they leave the ballpark and just like grab you by the shoulders and say, that was amazing. So I think that it's pretty special, and especially considering that we've been around for less than 2 years.
We're speaking with Brian Carmel, co-founder of the Oakland Ballers, here on State of the Bay on 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. Well, Brian, you certainly have created a lot of joy. Can you talk about how this idea started? What prompted you to launch the Ballers? How did you even come up with this idea of this independent league ball club here in Oakland?
Sure. So, you know, my co-founder, who is a very good friend of mine from high school, Paul Friedman, we went to high school together in Oakland, a long time ago in the mid-90s. And, you know, our friendship was forged in the fire of the Oakland Coliseum bleachers. And with a lot of our friends, sort of the Oakland sports identity is what really bonded us. And, you know, we always saw the ballpark as a place where diverse communities can come together for like a shared experience and shared joy. And so when it became clear that that was going away because Oakland was losing its third team in 5 or 6 years, it just felt like it was untenable to not have pro baseball in Oakland. It was like the final straw. So then Paul texts me and says, I have a crazy idea. And I said, great, I like crazy ideas. This is now like, I think June, late May, 2023. And he said, what if we started a new baseball team? And I said, yes, of course we should do that. Let's start a new baseball team, even though neither of us have any experience in sports, let alone professional sports. And, you know, we've done other things in our careers, but we just believed that we could accomplish this if we set out to do it. And we just recruited, you know, all the right people from across the community and really built a coalition and decided the team really needed to be built by all of Oakland in order to be successful. And that's what we've done.
Well, it's such a feel-good story, particularly after the celebrations last night. Really, it should be a movie. Moneyball 2, you know, a sequel to the A's story about how you guys really launched this project and made it a community-rooted and community-driven project. Can you talk about the ownership model here? I know fans have a say. They have an opportunity to buy into the team. You've got some celebrity investors. Can you talk about that aspect of the team?
We do. I mean, from the beginning, we wanted it to be a big tent. We wanted to have an aspect of fan ownership be sort of baked into the whole model. I think the reason is because of what happened with the MLB team leaving, right? Like they were leaving, and in our estimation, they were leaving what we considered to be the greatest fan base in America. And the value of the sports team really is that fan base. So it felt like they were walking away without the value. And if the value of a team is really its fan base and that's your customer, then you need to figure out how to have, you know, the fan base participate in that value. So we decided to try to craft a new model where the fans and the team would build value together. So, you know, we took in, I think, about 59, 60 investors in our early round before we even announced the team. And then once we were public, we you know, we've had two very successful community investment rounds, and now we have over 4,000 fan owners that own part of the Oakland Ballers.
And you've been unconventional in your approach. You made national news using an AI software program to manage one of the games. How did that go? And do you have any more plans to use AI in managing the team?
No, I think we were one and done. I think we it was a great experiment, and I'm glad we did it. Look, I think that innovation is a huge part of our values, and so we always want to try new things. Last year, we did a fan-controlled game. I think we will continue to try new things and iterate. I don't think that AI is a big part of that, but it was interesting to see the AI model and what decisions it would make, and I think ultimately proved what we already knew, which was, you know, Aaron Miles, our manager, is the best AI that you could ask for. And like, we're going to leave the baseball decisions to him going forward.
Former major leaguer Aaron Miles. So you play in a newly restored Raimondi Park in West Oakland. Can you talk about why that venue is meaningful and why fixing it up was a community project?
Sure. So yeah, Raimondi Park in West Oakland, historic baseball field in the 1950s and 60s. It was called by the Oakland Tribune quietly the park that produced more future MLB stars than any other baseball field in the country. We're talking about, you know, Vada Pinson, Frank Robinson, Curt Flood, basically the entire all-star outfield of the Cincinnati Reds at the time all grew up playing at Raimondi Park. You know, Bill Russell played there, and of course the Raimondi brothers. And so it had this history. And then when it first caught our eyes, which was a couple years ago, 2 years ago, it was really an unplayable Little League field. There was geese just sort of festering all over the place. You couldn't have a Little League game at Raimondi Park. And we partnered with the city, and that's how we got it done in the neighborhood and the community. And what we said to the city was, look, you know, right now there's this narrative that you can't get anything done in Oakland. And that's a narrative that's being, you know, put out there by that other team. And we help us, let's wrap our, you know, arms around each other and prove that of course we can get something done in Oakland. And that's what we did. We built the ballpark in just a few months in partnership with the city.
And what are your plans? What's next for the ballpark? I surveyed some of my Ballers fan friends and they wanted to know, I mean, are there going to be plans for bleachers on the warehouse past left field, the BART train car that you guys have in the parking lot? Will that be available for concessions? What's the sort of long-term vision for the ballpark here?
I think just to grow. I mean, yes, but okay. So BART train, our plan is to turn the BART train that BART really generously gifted us into like a concession stand and bar. So that's what we're going to do with that. And we want to keep growing the ballpark into sort of a living museum for Oakland baseball. So you can see that people have been reaching out to us and giving us the stomper statues that are all around Oakland. And we've turned that into what we call Scrappy's Sanctuary for Lost Animals. Scrappy, of course, Scrappy the Rally Possum is our mascot, and Stomper is the elephant that is now homeless from that other team. And so I think that conceptually, we're going to keep on building on this idea of a living museum for baseball. I think the specifics of how and when we're going to grow, it's probably a little bit premature to reveal any of that. But the idea is, you know, to just keep growing the fan base. It's so clear that there's a thirst for what we're delivering, this sort of joy that I talked about. And so we just need to get the word out there to more and more people. And as more and more people come, you know, that will prove that that the ballpark is ready for bigger things. We certainly intend to keep playing at Raimondi Park and to keep investing in West Oakland.
Well, greatly appreciate what you brought to the community. Congratulations again on the big victory, the championship season. Brian Carmel, co-founder of the Oakland Ballers, thanks so much for joining us here on State of the Bay.
Thanks so much, Ethan. Go Ballers.
And if you are a baseball fan, keep an eye out for opportunities to watch the Oakland Ballers next year. Coming up next, Governor Newsom just signed a package of climate and energy bills that is unusual in its coordination and scope. So we're going to learn about what this means for our future. So stay with us after this short break. Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. Late last week, Governor Newsom signed a package of bills addressing energy and climate issues in California. It's been called sweeping and astonishing in both its coordination and scope. So what pressures were legislators responding to in passing these bills? What compromises were made and with whom? Will California continue to be a climate leader? And perhaps most importantly, how will these bills affect you? Here to help us understand all of this, we're so pleased to be joined by Michael Wara, Senior Research Scholar at the Woods Institute for the Environment and Director of the Climate and Energy Policy Program at Stanford University. Welcome to State of the Bay, Michael.
Thank you, Ethan, for having me on.
Yeah, glad you can be with us. And we also want to welcome Blanca Begert, who covers climate change and the environment for Inside Climate News. Welcome to State of the Bay, Blanca.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, I'm hearing you a little bit muddled there, so hopefully we'll get your audio fixed up there, but very excited to have you both talk about these bills, really significant landmark package of bills that the legislature passed and now that Governor Newsom has signed. And before we dive in, I want to open up the phone lines. We want to hear from you, our listeners, to share your thoughts on these bills. So we're going to open up the phone lines a bit early tonight. If you have questions for our guests, give us a call anytime. We are at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also find us on social media and leave a comment there or question. You can always email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. So Michael Wara, let me start with you. You were quoted in CalMatters as saying that this package of bills that got through the legislature this year is quote, astonishing. So what did you find astonishing about what passed in Sacramento here?
Well, just that the governor's team and the legislative leadership were able to get so much done at the end of the session. We reauthorized cap and trade until 2045. We created the context that will allow a regional electricity market to develop in the Western US, including California. We passed a bill that's quite controversial that is aimed at doing some of the things we need to do to stabilize the refinery situation in California. The list just goes on and on. And all of these bills were, you know, not in print, like until the very last minute. It was all a kind of coordinated negotiation. And it's sort of like, you know, people talk when they talk about legislation about landing the plane, right? Like getting a deal done, getting the plane onto the tarmac. I've been a part of landing the plane in certain aspects of this. Oh, and I should add an $18 billion contribution to the wildfire fund to sort of shore up the insurance policy that our utilities and their customers benefit from. All of this getting done at the same time at the end of the session is a remarkable achievement. And I would just say, like, going into the last week of session, I was really nervous because while we had, you know, all these different pieces, the only thing that was in print was the big affordability package. And so my analogy is it's like the governor and the legislative leadership landed five planes on the same runway at the same time, and none of them crashed. And I'd say, like, you know, many of us do not love every aspect of the bills that did pass, but it is a remarkable achievement to get that much done at the same time.
Yes. Well, a lot to unpack there, and especially with the idea that so much of this came together at once. Also, for any listeners in the East Bay, did experience a slight jolt there. I know we had an earthquake earlier this morning. This is live radio, so hopefully everyone's okay with that jolt out here. I'm hosting the show from the East Bay. Blanca Begert, I want to go to you now. We heard Michael describe some of the highlights here of really what was a very comprehensive and surprising legislative session. You've put these bills into three buckets. Can you explain what those buckets are in your view?
Yeah, sure. And can you hear me better now?
Yes, you sound great.
Okay, great. So the big package that Newsom signed last week comprised of six bills, and there was multiple components, but I would loosely sort it into three buckets. So there was bills to address electricity affordability. California's rates are about twice the national average and are rising. So some of the bills signed were meant to address this. The biggest one did a number of things, including creating a way for utilities to use public financing to build transmission lines rather than charging ratepayers. It also blocked utilities from earning profits on a portion of the investments that they make in wildfire-related upgrades. And that means that they can't, you know, bill ratepayers for the return on those investments. Another bill, as Michael said, took the first steps to let California eventually join a west-wide energy market to buy and trade electricity with other entities that is supposed to bring down costs by creating a bigger and more efficient market. And then the other bucket is oil and gas. And the big thing there was the effort, quite controversial, as Michael said, to prevent against spiking gas prices. So here, you know, the history is that California leaders, including Newsom, went into sort of a panic in the spring when the second refinery of the year, Valero in Benicia, announced that it would soon be closing, next April. And then the Phillips 66 refinery in LA is also closing. So, you know, the companies have cited California's shift from away from fossil fuels and its state regulations, but regulators felt that they weren't ready to lose 18% of their refining capacity, which these two represent. And some analysts and the Energy Commission predicted potential shortages that could lead to gas price spikes, especially if more refineries close. So to prevent that, the state leaders landed on a bill to streamline permitting for oil drilling in Kern County, where it's been stagnating, that would waive review for 2,000 new oil wells a year. And so, you know, that was their move to address gas prices. Then the last bucket, I would just say, and I don't want to, you know, I can go into it more in detail, is extending the cap and trade program, you know, California's climate program that has had since 2012. It puts a cap on statewide carbon emissions and auctions permits that businesses can buy and trade to emit up to the cap. You know, it was called out by Trump this year. And so lawmakers vowed to extend it past its 2030 sunset date. And that's what they did.
Yes, a lot of detail there. And I think, Blanca, really helpful to kind of lay out the affordability concerns looming over this whole legislative session. Michael, I wanted to dig into some of these bills with you in a bit of detail. You know, and you both have already mentioned them, but really starting with cap and trade, and just in sort of basic, you know, layperson's terms, can you just describe what is cap and trade and who is impacted by this program and why Californians should be paying attention to this program, what it means to them?
Yeah, well, so cap and trade is a way of putting a cost on pollution that's emitted by polluters. And, you know, it can be, the mechanism can be applied to lots of different kinds of pollution. But in this case, we're talking about greenhouse gas emissions, so the cause of climate change. And California, for more than a dozen years, has had a program to basically force polluters to buy permits for every ton of greenhouse gas emissions that they emit. And the program has had a series of expiration dates. The first one was in 2020, and then the program was extended in 2017 to 2030. And then this time, the program was extended to 2045. The thing, I think probably the most, at least so far, the most consequential impact of cap and trade has not actually been the limit on pollution. It's been the money generated by selling the permits. And that has allowed, that's really provided funding for a lot of really important programs that help the energy transition, like EV charging infrastructure, in particular, affordable housing also, high-speed rail, somewhat controversially. So, you know, this program is going to continue. There were some modifications to it. I think the thing that to bear in mind is that the program is really entering a new phase where the caps, the limits on pollution, are falling faster than they were in the early years of the program. And so we're likely to see higher permit prices moving forward. That's my guess. I mean, you know, this is like predicting a market. It can be complicated and lots of factors, but structurally, the market had too many permits if it expired in 2030, and now it has too few permits given that it expires in 2045. So, and, you know, scarcity means higher
prices. Are the costs going to go up for people? Do you think that these costs will be passed on to consumers and energy prices?
They are. I think the truth is that, you know, money doesn't grow on trees, And if we're funding all of these programs using cap and trade, that money has to come from somewhere. And it comes from large emitters, and they tend to pass those costs on to their customers. So that's not always true. And you know, it can be true to varying degrees, but if the permit prices get a lot higher than they are now, then that would modestly increase energy prices in the state of California. The trick is, and this is the key, is using the money wisely, investing it, it's as the governor likes to say, so that that more than counter effects the increase in kind of the cost of old energy, right? If we're providing new options for people that they can get into, like, for example, lots of chargers so that you can feel comfortable buying an EV, then maybe you're not as worried if the price of gasoline is slightly higher. The same might be true for consumption of natural gas versus, you know, electric alternatives.
If you're just joining us, this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. And we truly are the Bay Area. Do want to note, we just had a 2.6 earthquake in Berkeley. So for our East Bay listeners, that was what you felt. And I'm Ethan Elkind, your host for this hour. We're discussing this new climate and energy bills that the California legislature just passed to address energy costs and climate concerns. We're joined by Michael Wara of Stanford University and Blanca Begert of Inside Climate News. We want to hear from you as well. Do you support what is in these bills? Do you think California should continue, is continuing to be a leader when it comes to climate change? You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or go ahead and email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Michael, I want to go back to you to ask about this regional power market. You referenced this earlier, and Blanca mentioned it as well. What is happening with this regional power market? Why is it significant? Why should people care about this?
Well, the basic idea is that when our utilities buy power to serve our needs in California, they mostly buy it in two ways. One way is kind of out of a power exchange called the California Independent System Operator. And the other is via long-term contracts. Oftentimes these contracts are with out-of-state energy producers. Like, for example, the Bonneville Power Administration up in the Pacific Northwest that sells a lot of hydro to California. And the thing is that folks may remember that we've had some close calls in the last few years with our electric reliability. These extreme climate-driven heat waves have kind of caught everybody by surprise. The governor's team responded by, and the PUC very assertively, by citing a lot of storage, battery storage in California to try to stabilize the grid. But this also just, it was revealing to grid operators that, like, we really need to deepen our cooperation with other states and the power, the electric power producers in other states. And so what this will allow is a governance structure where there's kind of shared governance of a multi-state power exchange. This is just a market. It's not anything else. We won't be planning what kind of power plants other states build, and they will not have any influence over what kind of power plants we build, but we will be able to trade power more easily and also understand during these shortage events where power is available. In the old way, and this is the way things worked in 2022 when we were short power, it's literally dialing for megawatts, where you have to know people and you call them up and you say, hey, do you have any extra natural gas fired capacity today because we're short in California? And you hope they say yes. The new way that this new power market will create will be much more like, we'll have a clear understanding of what's available everywhere and how to optimize the use of all of those resources across, you know, whichever states and utilities join the market. That's likely to improve reliability. It's also likely to lower costs because it'll mean that we can access the most affordable power. And also, and this is super important, these days we actually throw away a lot of solar power because we can't use it in California. This will give us a market into which to sell our excess solar power, especially in the fall and autumn months when we have too much of it. So I think there's a lot of benefits. There's a lot of historic resistance to this kind of an arrangement that really stems from what happened in the first electricity crisis in California, where Enron took advantage of a bad market design and really, you know, cleaned California out. And that the memory of that has really made this a hard thing to do, but I think the time is right. We have a lot of experience operating these markets safely and reliably without market manipulation. And so it's an important step for California. We're gonna be the biggest player in this market. We'll have a lot of influence in it, but we won't have total control because you need to share some power if you wanna have partners. And that's what this bill allows.
So another big step for California's electricity grid and potentially for ratepayers as well. We have an email question in from Jackson in San Francisco who writes, curious to know the behind the scenes stories of the compromises here, which interest groups were involved and where were the political parties on these bills? Blanca Beggard, I know you were covering this in depth there. What is your reporting telling you on how these bills came together?
I feel like all of these bills, in some ways, like each individually and all together, are all kind of connected and represent months and in some cases years of negotiation and, a whole different galaxy of compromises. So, for example, utilities, didn't like that the legislature wanted them to finance, originally $15 billion, it went down to $6 billion in wildfire mitigation upgrades with securitized bonds rather than capital investments that they could then earn a profit on. But then that bill also included a major provision that Michael mentioned, which was replenishing the wildfire fund, which is something that they, really wanted because, and he can probably speak more to that, but it was basically established to help utilities, tap into it to avoid bankruptcy if they're being sued for sparking a wildfire. And so the legislature voted to replenish that with $18 billion split from ratepayers and utility shareholders. There was negotiations obviously going on the oil front. The industry got streamlined permits for 2,000 new wells a year in Kern County, but that same bill contains some language that will make it more difficult to rehabilitate defunct oil pipelines for offshore drilling, which is pertinent to a rig that a company is trying to reopen off the coast of Santa Barbara. There was in the cap and trade negotiations there, the environmentalists wanted it to be stronger, oil industry wanted it to be weaker. And, that's also a fight that will continue because some decisions on how the program will be kind of updated and refreshed now that it's been reauthorized, will still be happening with the California Air Board.
Yeah, and Blanca, I know California legislature has a Democratic supermajority. Were these votes down party lines or were there some notable bipartisan support examples here?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I mean, last time that cap and trade was reauthorized under Jerry Brown, 20 was right before the 2020 expiry, he needed to win over Republicans to pass it. This time, that one was indeed along party lines, with Democrats supporting it, Republicans not, and that was fine. Even though they needed a two-thirds vote, as you said, there's a supermajority. The electricity and oil components here had more bipartisan support. Almost all the Republicans backed the bill to move towards regionalizing the electric grid that Michael spoke about. Some also got behind the push to make transition, make changes to transmission finance and replenish the wildfire fund. And then some Democrats, many of them supported the bill to permit the oil or to streamline permitting for oil wells in Kern, though a few progressive Democrats did vote against it. It was more bipartisan on those things than cap and trade.
Yes. So if you're just joining us again, this is State of the Bay on local public radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're discussing the sweeping new climate and energy bills that Governor Newsom signed last week. We're joined by Michael Wara, senior research scholar at the Woods Institute for the Environment and director of the Climate and Energy Policy Program at Stanford University, as well as Blanca Begert, who covers climate change and the environment for Inside Climate News. And we do want to hear from you. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Another listener, Deb, writes, as someone who's seen utility bills skyrocket, how soon will families actually start to see the difference in their monthly bills? Michael Wara, I know you've been tracking this issue, and you just talked about cap and trade proceeds potentially helping with this. Can you talk about what impacts not just cap and trade, but the grid regionalization, sort of totality of these measures might mean for people's electricity rates?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's first, the first thing to say is that electricity costs in the state of California are a crisis, and they're hurting people every day, especially in the hot parts of the state where AC is like, not just like a comfort, but a public safety, you know, public health issue. What I'd say is I think that the what got done in the legislature is going to help. There are lots of small pieces of it that will in various ways reduce costs. Whether, you know, they're not going to bring us back to a world that we once lived in where, you know, the bills in California were among the lowest in the country. And the reason for that is wildfire, right? You know, we are just burning down too many houses. And unfortunately, over the last decade, about half of the fires or half of the structure loss has been attributed to fires that utilities ignited. And that's just so much money at that, that, you know, that's driving the increases in rates, as is the utilities' desire to spend whatever it takes to avoid having repeats of that. And the combination of those two things is just driving a rapid escalation rate. So we gotta figure that out. And the, you know, I'll be honest, like the real answer there is not to be found in electricity. It is to be found in regulations like what was just finalized in Berkeley, in the upper parts of the Berkeley Hills, where, you know, homeowners for the first time are going to have to do things to their gardens to make them less ignition, make them less prone to igniting their homes in a wildfire. We need to reduce structure loss. That is the key. Utilities are playing an important part in that. Utilities start a lot fewer fires than they did in 2017, 2018. It is a dramatic change, but they're not perfect, and the conditions are getting more extreme. And so, you know, I think if there's one thing that's really, you know, missing or you know, where we really need to double down, it's on this, like, how do we make houses less prone to ignition? How do we make, you know, the houses and the gardens around them less prone to burning down neighborhoods like what happened in Altadena? And that's going to take time and work, but that is the way to really control electricity prices right now. And it's, I think we need to go faster there. It's controversial, but
yes, Michael, as we kind of zoom out here and think about the politics around this, just thinking about, and the wildfire issue obviously is so central to this, but just thinking about all these different issues, where are environmentalists and environmental justice groups kind of coming out on the bills that just passed? Any surprises for you there, or sort of notable fault lines?
You know, I think many people, especially the environmental justice groups, struggle to understand and support the strategy taken with respect to refineries. And I think that the bill on drilling really has to be understood in a context where Sivagunda, who is an energy commissioner, wrote a letter to Governor Newsom earlier in the session explaining what the CEC thinks the best strategy is to manage the decline for the falling demand for gasoline and diesel in California. That creates some complicated problems. And Commissioner Gunda had kind of a three-part strategy. And one of the parts was drilling, right? Like that we need to keep certain pipelines open to supply fuel to the refineries that are still open in order to keep those refineries open for a while. Now, there are other parts to this strategy. And the key thing I'm going to be watching is whether the Newsom administration, you know, they've gotten this law, this bill done to implement one part, but it's not even the main part. It's kind of the part that allows you to buy time so you can do the hard stuff. And now I want to see, and I think many people want to see, does the Newsom administration then follow through on doing the hard stuff? I expect they will. I think their intention is in the right place, but it's not going to be easy. And so, we've done this enhanced, drilling thing, lots of drilling permits. I am skeptical that a lot of wells are actually going to get drilled in California because it's just, we have an old oil industry, old fields, not very many drill rigs. Even if we issue permits, it may not make sense to use them. But we do need to pay attention to the closure of refineries. That is potentially very disruptive to the state's economy, given where we are. People are starting to buy lots of EVs, but they're by no means the majority of vehicles in California, and lots of people depend on gasoline-powered cars to get to work and take their kids to school. So we got to pay attention to that. And I think
Yes,
the administration is, but that's the place I think where there was the most, maybe the most controversy. I think there was a lot of support for the other legislation, a lot of people kind of holding their noses about certain aspects of the legislation in order to sort of get to yes, recognizing that in the present moment, as the federal government is walking away from climate change policy, California needs to double down and stand by its values and its beliefs that the future is a low carbon future, and we need to
Yes.
create that reality on the ground.
Well, we're just about out of time. Blanca, just very briefly, was Newsom's potential presidential ambitions looming over this? Do you think this will play into a potential run for him in 28?
Well, I know one of the things, the big things that Democrats took away from the presidential election is that they didn't focus enough on cost of living concerns. So anyone with an interest in getting elected anywhere is trying to focus on that. And the legislature said at the beginning of the session that was going to be affordability was going to be the theme. Obviously, it's been something that Newsom has been talking about a lot and trying to position himself as a Democrat who cares about utility and gas prices and will make things affordable. And kind of get around the liability that
Yeah,
might be
those.
associated with him being a governor of a state with a high cost of living. But yeah, I mean, will this work? I mean, it's like Michael said, there's more than just these measures that he's signed into law to actually address these costs. And these measures will take a while to really see even the difference that they make if they do make a big difference. And so yeah, it's I mean, affordability is definitely a very big thing in politics right now.
Still have our folks here. Michael, just wanted to finish with you. We just have a few seconds left here. Any issues still on the table that you think are going to be addressed next year?
Well, I think the big issue, that one thing that the big affordability bill also contains is a requirement to do a major study on how to manage the cost of wildfire better. And that'll be done by April of next year, with the thought that legislation that implements the recommendations of the study could happen next year. I think that is the looming problem, right? It's a problem for people's electricity bills. It's a problem for people's home insurance costs. And we got to figure it out and do better
Yeah.
than we're
All
doing.
right.
And
Well, I
so I think
appreciate
that's the
both.
undone.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry to have to cut you both off. There's a lot more we could talk about, but unfortunately, we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. Michael Wara, the Senior Research Scholar at the Woods Institute for the Environment and Director of the Climate and Energy Policy Program at Stanford. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Ethan.
And Blanca Begert, who covers climate change and environment for Inside Climate News. Thank you for being on State of the Bay here.
Thank you.
And coming up after the break, a new musical about September 9th, 2020, or the day the sky turned orange. We'll be right back.
Where were you the day the sky turned orange? That's what the actors at San Francisco Bay Area Theater Company are singing about. A San Francisco original, the R&B hip-hop musical The Day the Sky Turned Orange is a tribute to San Francisco and its journey through tougher times. Here to tell us about it are the theater company's artistic director and show director, Rodney Jackson, and actors Phaedra Tilly-Botton and William Schmidt. Phaedra, Rodney, William, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
It's great having you guys. I did see the show, so I have a reference point. But we're going to start with you, Rodney. September 9th, 2020, the day that very few of us in San Francisco will ever forget. People woke up with the sky, this apocalyptic burnt orange glow. Where were you on that day? And more importantly, how in the world did you decide to write a musical about it?
Thanks so much for having me, Fred. Yes, I was awoken by my mother. She called me and said, "Little Rodney, open the window. What is going on?" And I immediately closed my blinds and went right back to sleep. I thought I was in a dream. And it's funny enough, one of the songs in the show is called What a Dream. Mm-hmm. But the day the sky turned orange is a symbol of the times, born from fire, smoke, and necessity, honestly. What began as a kind of a TED Talk musical concept album has evolved into over 3.5 years, 2-act world premiere, a musical of, for, and by San Franciscan people. It's inspired by this Orange Skies Day on September 9th in 2020, when the wildfires turned the Bay Area skies the ominous orange color. But it's evolved with its music, its workshops, its scripts, its readings into a full-length musical for the Bay Area. Written by Julius Rayo, choreography by Vince Chung, direction by me, of course, Rodney Earl Jackson Jr., and music by Olivia Cooper Harris and David Michael Ott.
There's something interesting about the fact that everybody involved with this production has three names. Just want to bring that up.
You are funny. I have four names. I'm actually.
I know you do. You're a junior.
Rodney Earl Jackson Jr. Oh, get it right, Fred.
Eric Jr., as am I, but I won't tell you my name. We'll go to that later on. Phaedra, so Rodney talked about the musical being really an anthem to the city. What makes this musical so uniquely San Francisco?
So this musical is about not forgetting the past, because we also have to tell our own stories because they're being erased, but also allowing us to talk through it through music that touches our soul, that is comfortable with the Bay Area. It's R&B, it's music that you can groove to, you can smog to. This is something that you can feel and be a part of and feel like you can sing this music when you go home. But it's also Bay Area rich. So we say San Francisco, we call out places that are in the Bay. You see that on our set. So you feel welcomed in at home. And if you weren't around for the Orange Sky, and if you weren't in the Bay Area, then you get a taste of what did happen during that time, what it was like to be here. So it also pays homage to where we're from and tells a story of that to those that are not from here.
Yeah, it kind of evoked a feeling of survival when I was watching it, going, I forgot about that.
Yeah, we've come so far. Exactly. And it triggered change. Mm-hmm. Some of us are not the same as we were at that time. So it allows us to go back and remember what triggered this change. Why am I the person I am today? Because of what I went through during that time.
Which I think is a good thing. William, do you have anything to add to that? Got to bring you in.
Yes. I think in addition to the story being about resilience, I think it also the just technical elements and what you visually are seeing on stage, the costumes, the music you are hearing, is all very, very quintessential Bay Area. I keep coming back to the costumes because that's something I keep getting told that people are really liking, is that our costumes are outfits that people would actually be wearing on the streets in San Francisco today. So it screams Bay Area in that sense.
It does. So who are the characters we meet on stage and what stories do they tell? And don't forget to talk about your character, QC.
I will. So the story is about four different interconnected San Franciscans in on this day, right? And so we start with Amari, who is a teacher who is having to teach via Zoom, who is taking care of her brother, myself, QC, who is dealing with the effects of long COVID and feeling just out of place in what this new world and what his new body is. We meet Rayanne, who is Amari's boyfriend, who is a multifaceted person juggling a bunch of jobs just to be able to live in the city, right? Just to be able to live in San Francisco. So he's a stay-at-home therapist on Zoom. He's a delivery driver. People in the neighborhood know him. He's a handyman, right? And then we have Ale, who is a senior going into her senior year of high school, living in the Mission, coming from a home that isn't the most stable, but she's dealing with anxiety. She's dealing with all these different things that are going on that a normal senior has to deal with, and now put all that into 2020 and being stuck at home and not having an escape. So all four of these stories weave together into what this beautiful musical is about. And it's about, you know, the love and resilience.
It seems like a lot, but it's really easy and straightforward to follow. And I love following all the stories of the characters. Phaedra, can you tell us about the cast? I mean, I was blown away by the quality of the music, especially the voices. Just blew me away.
The cast is amazing. They are Bay Area artists, which is, you know, I stand hard on that, making sure that we're hiring in the Bay Area. But the cast is BIPOC, which is amazing. Uh-huh. Everyone is a person of color. The cast is made up of amazing performers. Nina Pacheco, there is also Rowan, who kills it. There's William Schmidt. There's, everybody is singing down. Everybody's singing down. The harmonies are amazing. We're backstage singing, so you're feeling like you're surrounded by love, even when there's only two people on stage. So it just feels like a really warm hug while going back into that time.
And it really does fill the theater. It really does. Rodney, tell us about the music. We've talked about it. We've alluded to it, but you're kind of the brainstorm behind all this. Tell us what inspired you and how you got to this point.
Yeah, the music. I love musical theater. I'm a kid who grew up on Sondheim and Rodgers and Hammerstein. I love the American canon of musical theater and Broadway. I wanted to make a musical that inspired the next generation of people to care about this art form, which is the kids. So I asked my dear friend, Olivia Cooper Harris. She and I went to college together, Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh. She's now on tour with Teddy Swims. She was just in the top 10 on The Voice, and she is our composer lyricist. And I said, I want a musical that is like your sound. What is R&B? What's hip right now? What's, you know, giving us a little flavor? We started developing the music, the sound, for 3 years. We interviewed people here in San Francisco, kids, families, people who experienced that day and got their stories. And that helped us understand the language around what we wanted to tell, the ideologies of the stories we wanted to tell. And it started to build a little bit of a rhythm, because there's like influences of hip hop, influences of K-pop, influences of R&B, influences of soul. I said, let's write a San Francisco jam, you know? And I think the music is like a love letter to San Francisco and a love letter to Mother Nature. It's like the heartbeat of the music is talking to this world that we want to make sure we continue to invest in, not forget about, not throw away.
Yeah, I think you hit on that. What message do you want audiences to take home from them after the show?
Music is therapeutic. Listen to the kids. They are our future.
Thank you, George Benson.
A lot of the messages and themes are inside of the lyrics of the songs that Olivia created, and they are just talking to Mother Nature. So the message is to come and get some medicine with us, because like Phaedra said, this musical is a time capsule. Not many people want to relive the last 5 years or go back to it. But like she said again, we hold your hand through it. It's a beautiful journey.
It really is. William, Phaedra, anything to add to that?
I want people to leave knowing that change is okay and change is necessary for us to move forward. And I think that part of specifically QC's journey through the show is coming to that term, and that change sometimes is what we need.
We cannot end this interview about a musical without having somebody sing. Mr. Schmidt, I'm going to put you on the spotlight. Do you have a favorite sing that you'd like to sing for us today?
Sure. I can sing a snippet of one of QC's songs. It embodies his character arc and what he's struggling with internally. I'll sing a little bit of it.
I'm in my dream, trying to find me. I gotta reach the memories, catch my breath, catch my stress, speak my soul. I don't know where to go, who to be, how to be me, the new me. I believe I'll find me, catch my breath, I'll go home.
Nice. If you want to see the show, and I loved it, and the singing's off the hook, the dancing, the cast are all uniformly excellent, and you got to hear William's beautiful voice. If you want to experience it for yourself, which I highly recommend, get your tickets for The Day the Sky Turned Orange at sfbatco.org. That's sfbatco.org. Performances are at Z Space in San Francisco now through October 5th. Rodney, Phaedra, William, thank you so much for being on State of the Bay. Appreciate y'all.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
All right, that was Fred Pitts, our co-host here on State of the Bay, doing that interview. And that's our show, State of the Bay, for this week. We hope you'll join us next Monday at 6, when we'll talk about scams in the age of AI, what you need to know about the latest tricks, traps, and deep fakes. And tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb and Jillian Emblad. Fred Pitts, as I mentioned, was our co-host. It was engineered by Devin Strolovich, and D Minor was our board operator. Coming up next is Not Born Yesterday, the show about the joys and challenges of aging. I'm Ethan Elkind. Good night, and thanks for listening.
This is 91.7 FM, KALW San Francisco, and online at KALW.org.